even if you die, Moneo. What is this thing of colours, Lord?
The continuum, the never-ending, the golden path.
But you see things which we do not, Lord.
Because you refuse.
Moneo sank his chin to his chest.
Lord, I know you have evolved beyond the rest of us. That is why we worship you and—
Damn you, Moneo!
Moneo jerked his head up and stared at Leto in terror.
Civilizations collapse when their powers outrun their religions, Leto said. Why can't you see this? Hui does.
She is Ixion, Lord. Perhaps she—
She's a fish speaker. She has been from birth, born to serve me. No.
Leto raised one of his tiny hands as Moneo tried to speak.
The fish speakers are disturbed because I called them my brides, and now they see a stranger not trained in Sihanouk who knows it better than they.
How can that be, Lord, when your fish—
What are you saying? Each of us comes into being knowing who he is and what he is supposed to do.
Moneo opened his mouth but closed it without speaking.
Small children know, Leto said. It's only after adults have confused them that children hide this knowledge even from themselves. Moneo, uncover yourself.
Lord, I cannot.
The words were torn from Moneo. He trembled with anguish.
I do not have your powers, your knowledge of—
Enough.
Moneo fell silent. His body shook. Leto spoke soothingly to him.
It's all right, Moneo. I asked too much of you, and I can see your fatigue.
Slowly, Moneo's trembling subsided. He drew in deep, gulping breaths. Leto said,
There will be some change in my Fremen wedding. We will not use the water rings of my sister, Ganima. We will use instead the rings of my mother.
The Lady Cheney, Lord? But where are her rings?
Leto twisted his bulk on the cart and pointed to the intersection of two cavernous spokes on his left, where the dim light revealed the earliest burial niches of the Atreides on Arrakis.
In her tomb, the first niche, you will remove those rings, Moneo, and bring them to the ceremony.
Moneo stared across the gloomy distance of the crypt.
Lord, is it not a desecration to—
You forget, Moneo, who lives in me.
He spoke then in Chaney's voice.
I can do what I want with my water rings.
Moneo cowered.
Yes, Lord. I will bring them with me to Tabor village, then.
Tabor village? Leto asked in his usual voice. But I have changed my mind. We will be wed at Tuono village.
Most civilization is based on cowardice. It's so easy to civilize by teaching cowardice. You watered down the standards which would lead to bravery. You restrain the will. You regulate the appetites. You fence in the horizons. You make a law for every movement. You deny the existence of chaos. You teach even the children to breathe slowly. You tame. The Stolen Journals.
Idaho stood aghast at his first close glimpse of Tuono village. That was the home of Fremen? The fish speaker troop had taken them from the citadel at daybreak. Idaho and Siona bundled into a large ornithopter accompanied by two smaller guard ships, and the flight had been slow, almost 3 hours. They had landed at a flat, round plastone hangar almost a kilometer from the village, separated from it by old dunes locked in shape with plantings of poverty grasses and a few scrubby bushes. As they came down, the wall directly behind the village had seemed to grow taller and taller, the village shrinking beneath such immensity.
The museum Fremen are kept generally uncontaminated by off-planet technology,
Naylor had explained, as the escort sealed the thopters into the low hangar. One of the troop already had been sent trotting off toward Tuono with the announcement of their arrival. Siona had remained mostly silent all during the flight, but she had studied Naylor with covert intensity. For a time during the march across the morning-lighted dunes, Idaho had tried to imagine that he was back in the old days. Sand was visible in the plantings, and in the valleys between dunes there was parched ground, yellow grass, the stick-like shrubs. Three vultures, their gap-tipped wings spread wide, circled in the vault of sky. The soaring search, Fremen had called it. Idaho had tried to explain this to Siona, walking beside him. You worried about the carrion eaters only when they began to descend.
I have been told about vultures, she said, her voice cold.
Idaho had noted the perspiration on her upper lip. There was a spicy smell of sweat in the troop pressed close around them. His imagination was not equal to the task of defocusing the differences between the past and this time. The issue still suits they wore were more for show than for efficient collection of the body's water. No true Fremen would have trusted his life to one of them, not even here, where the air smelled of nearby water. And the fish speakers of Naylor's troop did not walk in Fremen silence. They chattered among themselves like children. Siona trudged beside him in sullen withdrawal, her attention frequently on the broad, muscular back of Naylor, who strode along a few paces ahead of the troop. What was between those two women? Idaho wondered. Naylor appeared devoted to Siona, hanging on Siona's every word, obeying every whim Siona uttered, except that Naylor would not deviate from the orders which brought them to Tuono village. Still, Naylor deferred to Siona and called her Commander. There was something deep between those two, something which aroused awe and fear in Naylor. They came at last to a slope which dropped down to the village and the wall behind it. From the air, Tuono had been a cluster of glittering rectangles just outside the shadow of the wall. From this close vantage, though, it had been reduced to a cluster of decaying huts made even more pitiful by attempts to decorate the place. Bits of shiny minerals and scraps of metal picked out scroll designs on the building walls. A tattered green banner fluttered from a metal pole atop the largest structure. A fitful breeze brought the smell of garbage and uncovered cesspools to Idaho's nostrils. The central street of the village extended out across the sparsely planted sand toward the troop, ending in a ragged edge of broken paving. A robed delegation waited near the building of the green flag, standing there expectantly with a fish speaker messenger Naylor had sent on ahead. Idaho counted eight in the delegation, all men in what appeared to be authentic Fremen robes of dark brown. A green headband could be glimpsed beneath the hood on one of the delegation, the Naive, no doubt. Children waited to one side with flowers. Black hooded women could be seen peering from side streets in the background. Idaho found the whole scene distressing.
Let's get it over with, Siona said.
Naylor nodded and led the way down the slope onto the street. Siona and Idaho stayed a few paces behind her. The rest of the troop straggled along after them, silent now and peering around with undisguised curiosity. As Naylor neared the delegation, the one with the green headband stepped forward and bowed. He moved like an old man, but Idaho saw that he was not old, barely into his middle years. The cheeks smooth and unwrinkled, a stubby nose with nose scars from breath filter tubes. And the eyes. The eyes revealed definite pupils, not the all blue of spice addiction. They were brown eyes. Brown eyes in a Fremen.
I am Garun, the man said as Naylor stopped in front of him. I am Naib of this place. I give you a Fremen welcome to Tuono.
Naylor gestured over her shoulder at Siona and Idaho, who had stopped just behind her.
Are quarters prepared for your guests? We Fremen are noted for our hospitality, Garun said. All is ready.
Idaho sniffed at the sour smells and sounds of this place. He glanced through open windows of the flag-topped building on his right. The Atreides banner flying over that? The window opened into an auditorium with low ceiling, a band shell at the far end enclosing a small platform. He saw rows of seats, maroon carpeting on the floor. It had all the look of a stage setting, a place to entertain tourists. The sound of shuffling feet brought Idaho's attention back to Garun. Children were pressing forward around the delegation, extending clumps of garish red flowers in their grimy hands. The flowers were wilted. Garun addressed himself to Siona, correctly identifying the gold piping of Fish Speaker Command in her uniform.
Will you wish a performance of our Fremen rituals? He asked. The music, perhaps? The dance?
Naylor accepted a bunch of flowers from one of the children, sniffed them, and sneezed. Another urchin extended flowers toward Siona, lifting a wide-eyed stare toward her. She accepted the flowers without looking at the child. Idaho merely waved the children aside as they approached him. They hesitated, staring up at him, then scurried around him toward the rest of the troop. Garun spoke to Idaho.
If you give them a few coins, they will not bother you.
Idaho shuddered. Was this the training for Fremen children? Garun returned his attention to Siona. With Nayla listening, Garun began explaining the layout of his village. Idaho moved away from them down the street, noting how glances flicked toward him and then avoided his gaze. He felt deeply offended by the surface decorations on the buildings, none of it disguising the evidence of decay. He stared in an open doorway at the auditorium. There was a harshness in Tuono, a struggling something behind the wilting flowers and the servile tone of Garun's voice. In another time and on another planet, this would have been a donkey-in-the-street village, rope-belted peasants pressing forward with petitions. He could hear the whine of supplication in Garun's voice. These were not Fremen. These poor creatures lived on the margins, trying to retain parts of an ancient wholeness, and all the while that lost reality slipped farther and farther from their grasp. What had Leto created here? These Museum Fremen were lost to everything except a bare existence and the rote mouthing of old words which they did not understand and which they did not even pronounce correctly. Returning to Siona, Idaho bent to study the cut of Garun's brown robe, seeing a tightness in it dictated by a need to conserve fabric. The grey slick of a stillsuit could be seen underneath, exposed to sunlight, which no real Fremen would ever have let touch his stillsuit that way. Idaho looked at the rest of the delegation, noting an identical parsimonious treatment of fabric. It betrayed their emotional bent. Such garments allowed no expansive gestures, no freedom of movement. The robes were tight and confining in the way of these entire people. Disgust propelling him, Idaho strode forward abruptly and parted Garun's robe to look at the stillsuit. Just as he suspected, the suit was another sham. No arms to it. No boot pumps. Garun pulled back, putting a hand to the knife hilt Idaho had exposed at the man's belt.
Here, what are you doing? Garun demanded, his voice querulous. You don't touch a Fremen thus.
You a Fremen? Idaho demanded. I lived with Fremen. I fought by their sides against Harkonnens. I died with Fremen. You? You're a sham.
Garun's knuckles went white on the knife haft. He addressed himself to Siona.
Who is this man?
Nayla spoke up.
This is Duncan Idaho.
The Gola?
Garun turned to look at Idaho's face.
We have never seen your like here before.
Idaho felt himself almost overcome with desire to cleanse this place, even if it cost him his life, this diminished life, which could be repeated endlessly by people who had no real concerns for him.
An older model, yes.
But this was no Fremen.
Draw that knife or take your hand off it, Idaho said.
Garun jerked his hand away from the knife.
It is not a real knife, he said, only for decoration.
His voice became eager.
But we have real knives, even Chris knives. They are kept locked in the display cases to preserve them.
Idaho could not help himself. He threw his head back in laughter. Siona smiled. But Nayla looked thoughtful, and the rest of the fish speaker troop drew into a close, watchful circle around them. The laughter had an odd effect on Garun. He lowered his head and clasped his hands tightly together, but not before Idaho saw them trembling. When Garun peered upward once more, it was to look at Idaho from beneath heavy brows. Idaho felt abruptly sobered. It was as though some terrible boot had crushed Garun's ego into fearful subservience. There was watchful waiting in the man's eyes. And for no reason he could explain, Idaho remembered a passage from the Orange Catholic Bible. He asked himself,
Are these the meek who will outwait us all and inherit the universe?
Garun cleared his throat. Then,
Perhaps the Gola Duncan Idaho will witness our ways and our ritual and judge them?
Idaho felt shamed by the plaintive request. He spoke without thinking.
I will teach you anything Fremen that I know.
He looked up to see Nayla scowling at him.
It will help to pass the time, he said. And who knows, it may return something of the true Fremen to this land.
Siona said, We've no need to play old cultish games. Take us to our quarters.
Nayla lowered her head in embarrassment and spoke without looking at Siona.
Commander, there is a thing I have not ventured to tell you.
That you must make sure we stay in this filthy place,
Siona said.
Oh, no.
Nayla looked up at Siona's face.
Where could you go? The wall cannot be climbed, and there is only the river beyond it anyway. And in the other direction, it is the Sarir. Oh, no, it is something else.
Nayla shook her head.
Out with it,
Siona snapped.
I am under the strictest orders, Commander, which I dare not disobey.
Nayla glanced at the other members of the troop, then back to Siona.
You and the Duncan Idaho are to be quartered together. My father's orders? Lady Commander, they are said to be the orders of the God Emperor himself, and we dare not disobey.
Siona looked full at Idaho.
You will remember my warning, Duncan, when last we spoke at the Citadel?
My hands are mine to do with as I wish, Idaho snarled. I don't think you have any doubts about my wishes.
She turned away from him after a curt nod and looked at Garun.
What does it matter where we bed in this disgusting place? Take us to our quarters.
Idaho found Garun's response fascinating, a turning of the head toward the Gola, shielding the face behind the Fremen hood, then a secret, conspiratorial wink. Only then did Garun lead them away down the dirty street.
What is the most immediate danger to my stewardship? I will tell you. It is a true visionary. A person who has stood in the presence of God with the full knowledge of where he stands. Visionary ecstasy releases energies which are like the energies of sex, uncaring for anything except creation. One act of creation can be much like another. Everything depends upon the vision. The Stolen Journals.
Leto lay without his cart on the high, sheltered balcony of his little citadel tower, subduing a fretfulness which he knew came from the necessary delays putting off the date of his wedding to Hui Nori. He stared toward the southwest. Somewhere off there, beyond the darkening horizon, the Duncan, Siona, and their companions had been 6 days in Tuono village.
The delays are my own fault, Leto thought. I am the one who changed the place for the wedding, making it necessary for poor Maneo to revise all of his preparations.
And now, of course, there was the matter of Malki. None of these necessities could be explained to Maneo, who could be heard stirring about within the central chamber of the Eyrie, worrying about his absence from the command post where he directed the festive preparations. Maneo was such a warrior. Leto looked toward the setting sun. It floated low to the horizon, faded a dim orange by a recent storm. Rain crouched low in the clouds to the south beyond the Sarir now. In a prolonged silence, Leto had watched the rain there for a time, which had stretched out with no beginning or end. The clouds had grown out of a hard, grey sky, rain walking in visible lines. He had felt himself clothed in memories that came unbidden. The mood was hard to shake off, and without even thinking, he muttered the remembered lines of an ancient curse.
Did you speak, Lord?
Moneo's voice came from close beside Leto. By merely turning his eyes, Leto could see the faithful Major Domo standing attentively waiting. Leto translated into Gallic as he quoted,
The nightingale nests in the plum tree, but what will she do with the wind?
Is that a question, Lord?
An old question. The answer is simple. Let the nightingale keep to her flowers.
I don't understand, Lord.
Stop mouthing the obvious, Moneo. It disturbs me when you do that.
Forgive me, Lord.
What else can I do?
Leto studied Moneo's downcast features.
You and I, Moneo. Whatever else we do, we provide good theater.
Moneo peered at Leto's face.
Lord?
The rites of the religious festival of Bacchus were the seeds of Greek theater, Moneo. Religion often leads to theatre. They will have fine theatre out of us.
Once more Leto turned and looked at the southwest horizon. There was a wind there, now piling up the clouds. Leto thought he could hear driven sand blustering along the dunes, but there was only resonant quiet in the Tower Eyrie, a quiet with the faintest of wind hiss behind it.
"The clouds," he whispered. "I would take a cup of moonlight once more, an ancient sea barge at my feet, thin clouds clinging to my darkling sky, the blue-grey cloak around my shoulders and horses neighing nearby."
"My lord is troubled,"
Moneo said. The compassion in his voice wrenched at Leto.
"The bright shadows of my pasts," Leto said. "They never leave me in peace. I listened for a soothing sound, the bell of a country town at nightfall, and it told me only that I am the sound and soul of this place."
As he spoke, darkness enclosed the tower. Automatic lights came on around them. Leto kept his attention directed outward, where a thin melon slice of first moon drifted above the clouds with orange planet light revealing the satellite's full circle.
"Lord, why have we come out here?"
Moneo asked.
"Why won't you tell me?"
"I wanted the benefit of your surprise," Leto said. "A guild lighter will land beside us out here soon. My fish speakers bring Malki to me."
Moneo inhaled a quick breath and held it a moment before exhaling.
"Quiz, uncle, that Malki?"
"You are surprised that you had no warning of this," Leto said.
Moneo felt a chill all through his body.
"Lord, when you wish to keep things secret from—
Moneo?"
Leto spoke in a softly persuasive tone.
"I know that Malki offered you greater temptations than any other—"
"Lord, I never—"
"I know that, Moneo,"
still in that soft tone.
"But surprise has shocked your memories alive. You are armed for anything I may require of you."
"What? What does my lord—"
"Perhaps we will have to dispose of Malki. He is a problem."
"Me? You want me to—"
"Perhaps."
Moneo swallowed then.
"The Reverend Mother—"
"Antiak is dead. She served me well, but she is dead. There was extreme violence when my fish speakers attacked the place where Malki lay hidden."
"We are better off without Antiak,"
Moneo said.
"I appreciate your distrust of the Bene Gesserit, but I would that Antiak had left us in another way. She was faithful to us, Moneo."
"A Reverend Mother was—"
"Both the Bene Trelax and the Guild want Malki's secret," Leto said. "When they saw us move against the Ixians, they struck ahead of my fish speakers. Antiak, well, she could only delay them a bit, but it was enough. My fish speakers invested the place."
"Malki's secret, Lord?"
"When a thing vanishes," Leto said, "that is as much of a message as when a thing suddenly appears. The empty spaces are always worthy of our study."
"What does my lord mean, empty?"
"Malki did not die. Certainly I would have known that. Where did he go when he vanished?"
"Vanished from you, Lord? Do you mean that the Ixians—"
"They have improved upon a device they gave me long ago. They improved it slowly and subtly, hidden shells within hidden shells, but I noted the shadows. I was surprised. I was pleased."
Moneo thought about this.
"A device which concealed—" "Ah."
The God Emperor had mentioned a thing on several occasions, a way of concealing the thoughts he recorded. Moneo spoke.
"And Malki brings the secret of—"
"Oh, yes. But that is not Malki's real secret. He holds another thing in his bosom which he does not think that I suspect."
"Another? But, Lord, if they can hide even from you—"
"Many can do that now, Moneo. They scattered when my fish speakers attacked. The secret of the Ixian devices spread far and wide."
Moneo's eyes went wide with alarm.
"Lord, if anyone—"
"If they learn to be clever, they will leave no tracks," Leto said. "Tell me, Moneo, what does Nayla say about the Duncan? Does she resent reporting directly to you?"
"Whatever my lord commands."
Moneo cleared his throat. He could not fathom why his God Emperor spoke of hidden tracks, the Duncan and Nayla, in the same breath.
"Yes, of course,"
Leto said. Whatever I command, Nayla obeys. And what does she say of the Duncan?
He has not tried to breed with Sione, if that is my lord's.
But what does he do with my puppet Naive Garun and the other Museum Fremen?
He speaks to them of the old ways, of the wars against the Harkonnens, of the first Atreides here on Arrakis.
On Dune.
Dune, yes.
It's because there's no more Dune that there are no more Fremen, Leto said. Have you conveyed my message to Nayla?
Lord, why do you add to your peril?
Did you convey my message?
The messenger has been sent to Tuono, but I could still call her back.
You will not call her back.
But, Lord...
What will she say to Nayla?
That is your command for Nayla to continue in absolute and unquestioning obedience of my daughter, except in so far... Lord, this is dangerous.
Dangerous? Nayla is a fish speaker. She will obey me.
But Sione... Lord, I fear that my daughter does not serve you with all of her heart, and Nayla is...
Nayla must not deviate.
Lord, let us hold your wedding in some other place.
No.
Lord, I know that your vision has revealed...
The golden path endures, Moneo. You know that as well as I. Moneo sighed.
Infinity is yours, Lord. I do not question the...
He broke off as a monstrous, shuddering roar shook the tower, louder and louder. Both of them turned toward the sound. A descending plume of blue-orange light filled with swirling shockwaves came down to the desert less than a kilometer away to the south.
Ah, my guest arrives, Leto said. I will send you down on my cart, Moneo. Bring only Malki back with you. Tell the guildsmen this has earned my forgiveness, then send them away.
Your fault? Yes, Lord. But if they have the secret of...
They serve my purpose, Moneo. You must do the same. Bring Malki to me.
Obediently, Moneo went to the cart which lay in shadows at the far side of the eerie chamber. He clambered on it, watched a mouth of night appear in the wall. A landing lip extruded into that night. The cart drifted outward, feather light, and floated at an angle to the sand beside a guild lighter which stood upright like a distorted miniature of the little citadel's tower. Leto watched from the balcony, his front segments lifted slightly to provide him a better viewing angle. His acute eyesight identified the white movement of Moneo standing on the cart in the moonlight. Long-legged guild servitors came out with a litter which they slid onto the cart, standing there a moment in conversation with Moneo. When they left, Leto closed the cart's bubble cover and saw moonlight reflected from it. At his beckoning thought, the cart and its burden returned to the landing lip. The guild lighter lifted in its noisy rumbling while Leto was bringing the cart into the chamber's lights, closing the entrance behind it. Leto opened the bubble cover. Sand grated beneath him as he rolled to the litter and lifted his front segments to peer in at Malki, who lay as though sleeping, lashed into the litter by broad, grey, elastic bindings. The man's face was ashen under dark grey hair.
How he has aged, Leto thought.
Moneo stepped down off the cart and looked back at the litter's occupant.
He is injured, Lord. They want to send a medical...
They want to send a spy.
Leto studied Malki. The dark, wrinkled skin, the sunken cheeks, that sharp nose at such contrast with the rounded oval of his face. The heavy eyebrows had turned almost white. There, but for a lifetime of testosterone. Yes. Malki's eyes opened, such a shock to find evil in those doe-like brown eyes. A smile twitched Malki's mouth.
Lord, Leto!
Malki's voice was little more than a husky whisper. His eyes turned right, focusing on the major domo.
And Moneo. Forgive me for not rising to the occasion.
Are you in pain? Leto asked.
Sometimes.
Malki's eyes moved to study his surroundings.
Where are the Huris?
I'm afraid I must deny you that pleasure, Malki.
Just as well,
Malki husked.
I don't really feel up to their demands. Those were not Huris you sent after me, Leto.
They were professional in their obedience to me, Leto said.
They were bloody hunters.
Antiak was the hunter. My fish speakers were merely the clean-up crew. Moneo shifted his attention from one speaker to the other, back and forth. There were disturbing undertones in this conversation. Despite the huskiness, Malky sounded almost flippant. But then he had always been that way. A dangerous man. Leto said, "Just before your arrival, Moneo and I were discussing infinity."
"Poor Moneo," Malky said.
Leto smiled. "Do you remember, Malky? You once asked me to demonstrate infinity."
"You said no infinity exists to be demonstrated."
Malky swept his gaze toward Moneo.
"Leto likes to play with paradox. He knows all the tricks of language that have ever been discovered."
Moneo put down a surge of anger. He felt excluded from this conversation, an object of amusement by two superior beings. Malky and the God Emperor were almost like two old friends reliving the pleasures of a mutual past. "Moneo accuses me of being the sole possessor of infinity," Leto said. "He refuses to believe that he has just as much of infinity as I have." Malky stared up at Leto.
"You see, Moneo, you see how tricky he is with words?"
"Tell me about your niece, Hui Nori," Leto said.
"Is it true, Leto, what they say? That you are going to wed the gentle Hui?"
"It is true." Malky chuckled, then grimaced with pain.
"They did terrible damage to me, Leto," he whispered.
Then,
"Tell me, old worm,"
Moneo gasped. Malky took a moment to recover from pain, then,
"Tell me, old worm, is there a monster penis hidden in that monster body of yours? What a shock for the gentle Hui."
"I told you the truth about that long ago," Leto said.
"Nobody tells the truth,"
Malky husked. "You often told me the truth," Leto said, "even when you didn't know it."
"That's because you're cleverer than the rest of us."
"Will you tell me about Hui?"
"I think you already know it."
"I want to hear it from you," Leto said. "Did you get help from the Tleilaxu?"
"They gave us knowledge, nothing more. Everything else we did for ourselves."
"I thought it was not the Tleilaxu's doing." Moneo could no longer contain his curiosity.
"Lord, what is this of Hui and Tleilaxu? Why do you—" "Hey there, old friend Moneo," Malky said, rolling his gaze toward the majordomo. "Don't you know what he—"
"I was never your friend,"
Moneo snapped.
"Companion among the Huris, then," Malky said.
"Lord,"
Moneo said, turning toward Leto,
"why do you speak of—"
"Shh, Moneo," Leto said. "We are tiring your old companion, and I have things to learn from him yet."
"Did you ever wonder, Leto," Malky asked, "why Moneo never tried to take the whole shebang away from you?"
"The what?"
Moneo demanded.
"Another of Leto's old words," Malky said.
"She and bang. Shebang. It's perfect. Why don't you rename your empire, Leto? The Grand Shebang."
Leto raised a hand to silence Moneo.
"Will you tell me, Malky, about Hui?"
"Just a few tiny cells from my body," Malky said. "Then the carefully nurtured growth and education. Everything an exact opposite to your old friend Malky. We did it all in the No Room, where you cannot see."
"But I notice when something vanishes," Leto said.
"No Room?"
Moneo asked. Then, as the import of Malky's words sank home,
"You? You and Hui?"
"That is the shape I saw in the shadows," Leto said.
Moneo looked full at Leto's face.
"Lord, I will call off the wedding. I will say—"
"You will do nothing of the kind."
"But, Lord, if she and Malky are—"
"Moneo,"
Malky husked.
"Your Lord commands, and you must obey."
That mocking tone. Moneo glared at Malky.
"The exact opposite of Malky," Leto said. "Didn't you hear him?"
"What could be better?"
Malky asked.
"But surely, Lord, if you now know—"
Moneo, Leto said, you are beginning to disturb me.
Moneo fell into abashed silence. Leto said,
that's better. You know, Moneo, once, tens of thousands of years ago, when I was another person, I made a mistake.
You're a mistake?
Malky mocked.
Leto merely smiled. My mistake was compounded by the beautiful way in which I expressed it.
Tricks with words,
Malky taunted.
Indeed. This is what I said. The present is distraction, the future a dream. Only memory can unlock the meaning of life. Aren't those beautiful words, Malky?
Exquisite, old worm.
Moneo put a hand over his mouth.
But my words were a foolish lie,
Leto said.
I knew it at the time, but I was infatuated with the beautiful words. No, memory unlocks no meanings. Without anguish of the spirit, which is a wordless experience, there are no meanings anywhere.
I fail to see the meaning of the anguish caused me by your bloody fish speakers,
Malky said.
You're suffering no anguish,
Leto said.
If you were in this body, you'd...
That's just physical pain, Leto said. It will end soon.
Then when will I know the anguish?
Malky asked.
Perhaps later.
Leto flexed his front segments away from Malky to face Moneo.
Do you really serve the Golden Path, Moneo?
Ah, the Golden Path,
Malky taunted.
You know I do, Lord,
Moneo said.
Then you must promise me, Leto said, that what you have learned here must never pass your lips. Not by word or sign can you reveal it.
I promise, Lord. He promises, Lord,
Malky sneered. One of Leto's tiny hands gestured at Malky, who lay staring up at the blunt profile of a face within its grey cowl.
For reasons of old admiration and many other reasons, I cannot kill Malky. I cannot even ask it of you. Yet he must be eliminated.
Oh, how clever you are,
Malky said.
Lord, if you will wait at the other end of the chamber,
Moneo said.
Perhaps when you return, Malky no longer will be a problem. He's going to do it,
Malky husked.
God's below, he's going to do it.
Leto squirmed away and went to the shadowed limit of the chamber, keeping his attention on the faint arc of a line which would become an opening into the night if he merely converted the wish into a thought of command. What a long drop that would be out there. Just roll off the landing lip. He doubted that even his body would survive it. But there was no water in the sand beneath his tower, and he could feel the golden path winking in and out of existence merely because he allowed himself to think of such an end.
Leto!
Malky called from behind him. Leto heard the litter grating on the wind-scattered sand which peppered the floor of his eyrie. Once more Malky called,
Leto! You are the best! There's no evil in this universe which can surpass!
A sodden thump shut off Malky's voice.
A blow to the throat,
Leto thought.
Yes, Moneo knows that one.
There came the sound of the balcony's transparent shield sliding open, the rasping of the litter on the rail, then silence.
Moneo will have to bury the body in the sand,
Leto thought.
There is, as yet, no worm to come and devour the evidence.
Leto turned then and looked across the chamber. Moneo stood leaning over the railing, peering down, down, down.
I cannot pray for you, Malky, nor for you, Moneo, Leto thought. I may be the only religious consciousness in the Empire because I am truly alone, so I cannot pray.
You cannot understand history unless you understand its flowings, its currents, and the ways leaders move within such forces. A leader tries to perpetuate the conditions which demand his leadership. Thus, the leader requires the outsider. I caution you to examine my career with care. I am both leader and outsider. Do not make the mistake of assuming that I only created the church, which was the state. That was my function as leader, and I had many historical models to use as pattern. For a clue to my role as outsider, look at the arts of my time. The arts are barbaric. The favorite poetry, the epic. The popular dramatic ideal, heroism. Dances, wildly abandoned. From Mineo's viewpoint, he is correct in describing this as dangerous. It stimulates the imagination. It makes people feel the lack of that which I have taken from them. What did I take from them? The right to participate in history. The Stolen Journals.
Idaho, stretched out on his cot with his eyes closed, heard a weight drop onto the other cot. He sat up into the mid-afternoon light, which slanted through the room's single window at a sharp angle, reflecting off the white-tiled floor onto the light yellow walls. Siona, he saw, had come in and stretched herself on her cot. She already was reading one of the books she carried around with her in a green fabric pack. Why books? He wondered. He swung his feet to the floor and glanced around the room. How could this high-ceilinged, spacious box be considered even remotely Fremen? A wide table-slash-desk of some dark brown local plastic separated the two cots. There were two doors. One led directly outside across a garden. The other admitted them to a luxurious bath whose pale blue tiles glistened under a broad skylight. The bath contained, among its many functional services, a sunken tub and a shower, each at least 2 meters square. The door to this sybaritic space remained open, and Idaho could hear water running out of the tub. Siona appeared oddly fond of bathing in an excess of water. Stilgar, Idaho's naib of the ancient days on Dune, would have looked on that room with scorn.
Shameful, he would have said. Decadent. Weak.
Stilgar would have used many scornful words about this entire village, which dared to compare itself with a true Fremen siege. Paper rustled as Siona turned a page. She lay with her head propped on two pillows, a thin white robe covering her body. The robe still revealed clinging wetness from her bath. Idaho shook his head. What was it on those pages which held her interest this way? She had been reading and rereading since their arrival at Tuono. The volumes were thin but numerous, bearing only numbers on their black bindings. Idaho had seen a number 9. Swinging his feet to the floor, he stood and went to the window. There was an old man out there at a distance, digging in flowers. The garden was protected by buildings on 3 sides. The flowers bore large blossoms, red on the outside, but when they unfolded, white in the center. The old man's uncovered gray hair was a kind of blossom, waving among the floral, white and jeweled buds. Idaho smelled mouldering leaves and freshly turned dirt against a background of pungent floral perfume. A Fremen, tending flowers in the open. Siona volunteered nothing about her strange reading matter. She's taunting me, Idaho thought. She wants me to ask. He tried not to think about Hui. Rage threatened to engulf him when he did. He remembered the Fremen word for that intense emotion, Kanawa, the iron ring of jealousy. Where is Hui? What is she doing at this moment? The door from the garden opened without a knock, and Teishar, an aide to Garun, entered. Teishar had a dead, colored face full of dark wrinkles. His eyes were sunken with pale yellow around the pupils. Teishar wore a brown robe. He had hair like old grass that had been left out to rot. He seemed unnecessarily ugly, like a dark and elemental spirit. Teishar closed the door and stood there looking at them. Siona's voice came from behind Idaho.
Well, what is it?
Idaho noticed then that Teishar seemed strangely excited, vibrating with it.
The God Emperor!
Teishar cleared his throat and began again.
The God Emperor will come to Tuono.
Siona sat upright on the bed, folding her white robe over her knees. Idaho glanced back at her, then once more to Teishar.
He will be wed here in Tuono, Teishar
said.
It will be done in the ancient Fremen way. The God Emperor and his bride will be guests of Tuono.
Full in the grip of Kanawa, Idaho glared at him, fists clenched. Teyashar bobbed his head briefly, turned, and let himself out, shutting the door hard.
Let me read you something, Duncan, Siona said.
Idaho was a moment understanding her words. Fists still clenched at his sides, he turned and looked at her. Siona sat on the edge of her cot, a book in her lap. She took his attention as agreement.
Some believe, she read, that you must compromise integrity with a certain amount of dirty work before you can put genius to work. They say the compromise begins when you come out of the Sanctus, intending to realize your ideals. Morneo says my solution is to stay within the Sanctus, sending others to do my dirty work.
She looked up at Idaho.
The God Emperor. His own words.
Slowly, Idaho relaxed his fists. He knew he needed this distraction, and it interested him that Siona had emerged from her silence.
What is that book? He asked.
Briefly, she told him how she and her companions had stolen the Citadel charts and the copies of Leto's journals.
Of course you knew about that, she said. My father has made it plain that spies betrayed our raid.
He saw the tears latent in her eyes.
Nine of you killed by the wolves?
She nodded.
You're a lousy commander, he said.
She bristled, but before she could speak, he asked, Who translated them for you?
This is from Ix. They say the guild found the key.
We already knew our god emperor indulged in expedients, Idaho said. Is that all he has to say?
Read it for yourself.
She rummaged in her pack beside the cot and came up with the first volume of the translation, which she tossed across to his cot. As Idaho returned to the cot, she demanded,
What do you mean I'm a lousy commander?
Wasting nine of your friends that way.
You fool!
She shook her head.
You obviously never saw those wolves.
He picked up the book and found it heavy, realizing then that it had been printed on crystal paper.
You should have armed yourselves against the wolves, he said, opening the volume.
What arms? Any arms we could get would have been useless.
Laser guns? He asked, turning a page.
Touch a laser gun on Arrakis, and the worm knows it.
He turned another page.
Your friends got laser guns eventually.
And look what it got them.
Idaho read a line, then
poisons were available.
She swallowed convulsively. Idaho looked at her.
You did poison the wolves after all, didn't you?
Her voice was almost a whisper.
Yes.
Then why didn't you do that in advance? He asked.
We didn't know we could.
But you didn't test it,
Idaho said. He turned back to the open volume.
A lousy commander.
He's so devious, Siona said.
Idaho read a passage in the volume before returning his attention to Siona.
That hardly describes him. Have you read all of this?
Every word, some of them several times.
Idaho looked at the open page and read aloud.
I have created what I intended, a powerful spiritual tension throughout my empire. Few sense the strength of it. With what energies did I create this condition? I am not that strong. The only power I possess is the control of individual prosperity. That is the sum of all the things I do. Then why do people seek my presence for other reasons? What could lead them to certain death in the futile attempt to reach my presence? Do they want to be saints? Do they think that thus they gain the vision of God?
He's the ultimate cynic,
Siona said, tears apparent in her voice.
How did he test you? Idaho asked.
He showed me his golden path.
That's convenient.
It's real enough, Duncan.
She looked up at him, her eyes glistening with unshed tears.
But if it was ever a reason for our God Emperor, it is not reason for what he has become.
Idaho inhaled deeply. Then,
the Atreides come to this.
The worm must go,
Siona said.
I wonder when he's arriving, Idaho said.
Garun's little rat friend didn't say.
We must ask, Idaho said.
We have no weapons, Siona said.
Nayla has a laser gun, he said. We have knives. Rope. I saw rope in one of Garun's storage rooms.
Against the worm? She asked. Even if we could get Niala's laser gun, you know it won't touch him.
But is his cart proof against it? Idaho asked.
I don't trust Nayla,
Siona said. Doesn't she obey you?
Yes, but...
We will proceed one step at a time, Idaho said. Ask Nayla if she would use her laser gun against the worm's cart.
And if she refuses?
Kill her. Siona stood, tossing her book aside. How will a worm come to Tuono? Idaho asked. He's too big and heavy for an ordinary thopter.
Garun will tell us, she said. But I think he will come as he usually travels.
She looked up at the ceiling, which concealed the Sarir's perimeter wall.
I think he will come on peregrination with his entire crew. He will come along the royal road and drop down to here on suspensus.
She looked at Idaho.
What of Garun?
A strange man, Idaho said. He wants more desperately to be a real Fremen. He knows he is not anything like what they were in my day.
What were they like in your day, Duncan?
They had a saying which describes it, Idaho said. You should never be in the company of anyone with whom you would not want to die.
Did you say this to Garun? She asked.
Yes.
And his response?
He said I was the only such person he had ever met.
Garun may be wiser than any of us, she said.
You think power may be the most unstable of all human achievements? Then what of the apparent exceptions to this inherent instability? Some families endure. Very powerful religious bureaucracies have been known to endure. Consider the relationship between faith and power. Are they mutually exclusive when each depends upon the other? The Bene Gesserit have been reasonably secure within the loyal walls of faith for thousands of years. But where has their power gone? The Stolen Journals.
Moneo spoke in a petulant tone.
Lord, I wish you had given me more time.
He stood outside the citadel in the short shadows of noon. Leto lay directly in front of him on the imperial cart, its bubble hood retracted. He had been touring the environs with Hui Nori, who occupied a newly installed seat within the bubble cover's perimeter and just beside Leto's face. Hui appeared merely curious about all the bustle which was beginning to increase around them.
How calm she is,
Moneo thought. He repressed an involuntary shudder at what he had learned of her from Malki. The God Emperor was right. Hui was exactly what she appeared to be, an ultimately sweet and sensible human being.
Would she really have mated with me?
Moneo wondered. Distractions drew his attention away from her. While Leto had toured Hui around the citadel on the suspensor-borne cart, a great troop of courtiers and fish speakers had been assembled here, all the courtiers in celebration finery, brilliant reds and golds dominant. The fish speakers wore their best dark blues, distinguished only by the different colours in the piping and hawks. A baggage caravan on suspensor sleds had been drawn up at the rear with fish speakers to pull it. The air was full of dust and the sounds and smells of excitement. Most of the courtiers had reacted with dismay when told their destination. Some had immediately purchased their own tents and pavilions. These had been sent on ahead, with the other impediments piled now on the sand just outside Tuono's view. The fish speakers in the entourage were not taking this in a festive mood. They had complained loudly when told they could not carry laser guns.
Just a little more time, Lord, Moneo was saying. I still don't know how we will...
There's no substitute for time in solving many problems, Leto said. However, you can place too much reliance on it. I can accept no more delays.
We will be 3 days just getting there,
Moneo complained. Leto thought about that time, the swift walk-trot-walk of a peregrination, 180 kilometers. Yes, 3 days.
I'm sure you've made good arrangements for the way stops, Leto said. Plenty of hot water for the muscle cramps?
We'll be comfortable enough, Moneo said. But I don't like leaving the citadel in these times, and you know why.
We have communications devices, loyal assistants. The guild is suitably chastened. Calm yourself, Moneo.
We could hold the ceremony in the citadel.
For answer, Leto closed the bubble cover around him, isolating Hui with him.
Is there danger, Leto?
She asked.
There's always danger.
Moneo sighed, turned and trotted toward where the royal road began its long climb eastward before turning south around the Sarir. Leto set his cart in motion behind the major domo, heard his motley troop fall into step behind them.
Are we all moving? Leto asked.
Hui glanced backward around him.
Yes,
she turned toward his face.
Why was Moneo being so difficult?
Moneo has discovered that the instant which has just left him is forever beyond his reach.
He has been very moody and distracted since you returned from the little citadel. He is not the same at all.
He is an Atreides, my love, and you were designed to please an Atreides.
It's not that. I would know if it were that.
Yes. Well, I think Moneo has also discovered the reality of death.
What's it like at the little citadel when you're there with Moneo?
She asked.
It's the loneliest place in my empire.
I think you avoid my questions,
she said.
No, love. I share your concern for Moneo, but no explanation of mine will help him now. Moneo is trapped. He has learned that it is difficult to live in the present, pointless to live in the future, and impossible to live in the past.
I think it's you who have trapped him, Leto.
But he must free himself.
Why can't you free him?
Because he thinks my memories are his key to freedom. He thinks I am building our future out of our past.
Isn't that always the way of it, Leto?
No, dear Hui.
Then how is it?
Most believe that a satisfactory future requires a return to an idealized past, a past which never in fact existed.
And you, with all of your memories, know otherwise.
Leto turned his face within its cowl to stare at her, probing, remembering. Out of the multitudes within him he could form a composite, a genetic suggestion of Hui, but the suggestion fell far short of the living flesh. That was it, of course. The past became row on row of eyes, staring outward like the eyes of gasping fish, but Hui was vibrant life. Her mouth was set in Grecian curves designed for a Delphic chant, but she hummed no prophetic syllables. She was content to live, an opening person like a flower perpetually unfolding into fragrant blossom.
"Why are you looking at me like that?" she asked.
"I was basking in the love of you."
"Love, yes," she smiled. "I think that since we cannot share the love of the flesh, we must share the love of the soul. Would you share that with me, Leto?"
He was taken aback.
"You ask about my soul?"
"Surely others have asked."
He spoke shortly.
"My soul digests its experiences, nothing more."
"Have I asked too much of you?"
she asked.
"I think that you cannot ask too much of me."
"Then I presume upon our love to disagree with you. My uncle Malki talked about your soul."
He found that he could not respond. She took his silence as an invitation to continue.
"He said that you were the ultimate artist at probing the soul, your own soul first."
"But your uncle Malki denied that he had a soul of his own."
She heard the harshness in his voice, but was not deterred.
"Still, I think he was right. You are the genius of the soul, the brilliant one."
"You need only the plodding perseverance of duration," he said. "No brilliance."
They were well onto the long climb to the top of the Sarir's perimeter wall now. He lowered his cart's wheels and deactivated the suspensors. Hui spoke softly, her voice barely audible above the grating sound of the cart's wheels and the running feet all around them.
"May I call you love, anyway?"
He spoke around a remembered tightness in a throat which was no longer completely human.
"Yes."
"I was born an Ixion, love," she said. "Why don't I share their mechanical view of our universe? Do you know my view, Leto, my love?"
He could only stare at her.
"I sense the supernatural at every turning," she said.
Leto's voice rasped, sounding angry even to him.
Each person creates his own supernatural.
Don't be angry with me, love.
Again, that awful rasping.
It is impossible for me to be angry with you.
But something happened between you and Malki once, she said. He would never tell me what it was, but he said he often wondered why you spared him.
Because of what he taught me.
What happened between you two, love?
I would rather not talk about Malki.
Please, love. I feel that it's important for me to know.
I suggested to Malki that there might be some things men should not invent.
And that's all?
No. He spoke reluctantly. My words angered him. He said, "You think that in a world without birds, men would not invent aircraft? What a fool you are. Men can invent anything."
He called you a fool?
There was shock in Hui's voice. He was right. And although he denied it, he spoke the truth. He taught me that there was a reason for running away from inventions.
Then you fear the Ixians?
Of course I do. They can invent catastrophe.
Then what could you do?
Run faster. History is a constant race between invention and catastrophe. Education helps, but it's never enough. You also must run.
You are sharing your soul with me, love. Do you know that?
Leto looked away from her and focused on Moneo's back, the motions of the majordomo, the tucked-in pretenses of secrecy so apparent there. The procession had come off the first gentle incline. It turned now to begin the climb onto Ringwall West. Moneo moved as he had always moved, one foot ahead of another, aware of the ground where he would place each step. But there was something new in the majordomo. Leto could feel the man drawing away, no longer content to march beside his lord's cowled face, no longer trying to match himself to his master's destiny. Off to the east, the Sarir waited. Off to the west, there was the river, the plantations. Moneo looked neither left nor right. He had seen another destination.
You do not answer me, Hui said.
You already know the answer.
Yes, I am beginning to understand something of you, she said. I can sense some of your fears, and I think I already know where it is that you live.
He turned a startled glance on her and found himself locked in her gaze.
It was astonishing.
He could not move his eyes away from her. A profound fear coursed through, and he felt his hands begin to twitch.
You live where the fear of being and the love of being are combined all in one person, she said.
He could not blink.
You are a mystic, she said, gentle to yourself only because you are in the middle of that universe looking outward, looking in ways that others cannot. You fear to share this. Yet you want to share it more than anything else.
What have you seen? He whispered.
I have no inner eye, no inner voices, she said. But I have seen my Lord Leto, whose soul I love, and I know the only thing that you truly understand.
He broke from her gaze, fearful of what she might say. The trembling of his hands could be felt all through his front segment.
Love. That is what you understand, she said. Love. And that is all of it.
His hands stopped trembling. A tear rolled down each of his cheeks. When the tears touched his cowl, wisps of blue smoke erupted. He sensed the burning and was thankful for the pain.
You have faith in life, Hui said. I know that the courage of love can reside only in this faith.
She reached out with her left hand and brushed the tears from his cheeks. It surprised him that the cowl did not react with its ordinary reflex to prevent the touch.
Do you know, he asked, that since I have become thus, you are the first person to touch my cheeks?
But I know what you are and what you were, she said.
What I was. Ah, Hui. What I was has become only this face, and all the rest is lost in the shadows of memory, hidden, gone.
Not hidden from me, love.
He looked directly at her. no longer afraid to lock gazes.
Is it possible that the Ixians know what they have created in you?
I assure you, Leto, love of my soul, that they do not know. You are the first person, the only person to whom I have ever completely revealed myself.
Then I will not mourn for what might have been, he said. Yes, my love, I will share my soul with you.
Think of it as plastic memory, this force within you which trends you and your fellows toward tribal forms. This plastic memory seeks to return to its ancient shape, the tribal society. It is all around you. The feudatory, the diocese, the corporation, the platoon, the sports club, the dance troops, the rebel cell, the planning council, the prayer group, each with its master and servants, its host and parasites, and the swarms of alienating devices, including these very words, tend eventually to be enlisted in the argument for a return to those better times. I despair of teaching you other ways. You have square thoughts which resist circles. The Stolen Journals.
Idaho found he could manage the climb without thinking about it. This body, grown by the Tleilaxu, remembered things the Tleilaxu did not even suspect. His original youth might be lost in the eons, but his muscles were Tleilaxu young, and he could bury his childhood in forgetfulness while he climbed. In that childhood, he had learned survival by flight into the high rocks of his home planet. It did not matter that these rocks in front of him now had been brought here by men. They also had been shaped by ages of weather. The morning sun was hot on Idaho's back. He could hear Siona's efforts to reach the relatively simple support position of a narrow ledge far below him. The position was virtually useless to Idaho, but it had been the argument which had brought Siona finally into agreement that they should attempt this climb. They. She had objected that he might try it alone. Nayla, three of her fish speaker aides, Garun, and three chosen from his museum Fremen, waited on the sand at the foot of the barrier wall which enclosed the Sarir. Idaho did not think about the wall's height. He thought only about where he would next put a hand or a foot. He thought about the coil of light rope around his shoulders. That rope was the tallness of this wall. He had measured it out on the ground, triangulating across the sand, not counting his steps. When the rope was long enough, it was long enough. The wall was as high as the rope was long. Any other way of thinking could only dull his mind. Feeling for handholds which he could not see, Idaho groped his way up the sheer face. Well, not quite sheer. Wind and sand, and even some rain, the forces of cold and heat, had been at their erosive work here for more than 3,000 years. For one full day, Idaho had sat on the sand below the wall, and he had studied what had been accomplished by time. He had fixed certain patterns in his mind, a slanting shadow, a thin line, a crumbling bulge, a tiny lip of rock here and another over there. His fingers wriggled upward into a sharp crack.